From the BBC in London, this is Brian Matthew introducing The Beatles Story.
Strawberry feels forever. Strawberry feels forever. Strawberry feels forever.
It's the latter part of 1966, and after yet another hectic tour of America and considerable aggravation in Manila, the Beatles have had more than enough of life on the road and have decided not to tour anymore. Instead, they're going to concentrate on writing and recording. They've dabbled with various soft drugs, and their music is beginning to change. Part 8, The Psychedelic Chapter. Yes, Strawberry Fields Forever, The Other Side of Penny Lane, issued early in 1967.
Penny Lane, there is a barber showing photographs of every head he's had the pleasure to know, and all the people that come and go stop and say hello. On the corner is a banker with a motor car, the little children laughing him behind his back, and the banker never wears a Mac in the pouring rain. Very strange. Penny Lane is in my ears and in my eyes. There beneath the blue suburban skies I sit and meanwhile back in Penny Lane. Shaves another customer. We see the banker sitting waiting for a trim. And then the fireman rushes in.
On the top side, the music may have been pretty conventional, but underneath, a revolution was starting. George Martin explains.
I think the Strawberry Fields did represent the major change in the boys' lives. It was the beginning of the Pepper episode, and it was the beginning of the highly imaginative, some people say a psychedelic way of writing. I prefer to think of it as being complete tone poem imagery. You know, I think it's more like a modern Debussy, if you like, or Ravel. I think that their ideas there had developed enormously in a very flowery way, but a very sensible way. And I regard Strawberry Fields as being really a very great song. And I think it's probably one of the best records ever made. It was the only first record to hit the ignominious spot of number two. And Penny Lane was entirely a Paul composition. Strawberry Fields was entirely a John composition, and I think you can see the difference in the two there. With Strawberry Fields, we did two recordings of this. The first time, we made a record with just the boys themselves, and it worked out pretty well, I thought, anyway. And John went away and listened to the lacquers that we cut of it. And he came back to me and said, George, he said, I don't think it's really what I had in mind when I first wrote it. And I had to admit, I said, well, you know, honestly, John, it has worked out rather heavier than I first thought when you sat and played it to me on an acoustic guitar. I thought it was going to be a little more flowing than it has been. He said, well, that's the point. He said, I want to make it a little more smooth. Can you do a score for me and we'll do a new record? So I scored it for some cellos and for some trumpets and various things. And we made another record of Strawberry Fields Forever. And he went away and listened to that. And he said, it's very much better. I like it much better. But it's still not right. There's a lot in the original recording that's really better than this one. It's a pity we can't have the two together. He said, if we could take the beginning of one and the end of another, that'd be great. So I listened to them both, and I said, well, there's only one thing, John. To begin with, they're completely different tempos, and they're in two different keys. Apart from that, it'd be very easy to cut them together. So he looked at me and smiled, and he said, well, I'm sure you can fix it. And, of course, this is a terrible challenge. Well, by the grace of God and a bit of luck, I found out that by reducing the speed of one of the recordings, and by speeding up the other, the tempo change accounted for the intonation change of half tone. So, in fact, I did cut the two recordings together. And the record you hear today is two separate recordings in two different keys, edited together.
Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields. Nothing is real. Standing all you see, it's getting hard to be someone, but it all works out. It doesn't matter much to me. Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields. Nothing is real. Nothing to get hung about. Strawberry Fields Forever. No one I think is in my tree. I mean, it must be high or low. That is, you can't, you know, tune in, but it's all right. That is, I think it's not too bad. Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields. Nothing is real, and nothing to get hung about. Strawberry Fields Forever. Always know, sometimes think it's me, but you know I know when it's a dream. I think I know, I mean, yes, but it's all wrong. That is, I think I disagree. Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields. Nothing is real. Nothing to get hung about. Strawberry Fields Forever. Strawberry Fields Forever. Strawberry Fields Forever.
Strawberry Fields. It's pretty straightforward, isn't it? Let me, how's it go?
Let me take you down, that's it.
Yeah.
it's not about, it's just about me, really. Mm. Or anybody else that's thinking like that.
Yeah. It's just a random it's question of thoughts.
I mean, it says it here.
What does it say?
It's pretty straightforward, isn't it? It's just a bit of messy and then let's get away to Strawberry Fields. A bit of messy and let's get away to Strawberry Fields. It's just, you know. It's fantastic to me, maybe, at certain points when you're doing it. And then after that, you can't listen to it objectively. And it takes till about now, say, to really listen to it and understand what you're really talking about yourself.
On June the 1st, it was time for another album.
We're sitting in the Hush Semicircular Theatre waiting for the Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band to come on, and here they come now, playing the first number one. Let's go. All right. Fantastic. I can't do it from home, I'll be dizzy. I'd like to play you one. That's a sad little song. Where's it gone? Oh, this is it, yeah. Picture yourself on an old-fashioned elephant. Lucy in the sky for everyone. Now.
Picture yourself in a boat on a river with tangerine trees and marmalade skies. Somebody calls you, you answer quite slowly. A girl with kaleidoscope eyes. Cellophane flowers of yellow and green towering over your head. Look for the girl with the sun in her eyes and she's gone. Lucy in the sky with diamonds. Eat marshmallow pies. Everyone smiles as you drift past the flowers that grow so incredibly high. Newspaper taxis appear on the shore, waiting to take you.
Kenny Everett knows the story behind that one.
Are you sitting comfortably? Then I begin. One day, months ago, Julian, son of Lennon, came home from school with a painting he'd just drawn. A picture of a lady bursting with colours. John Lennon said,
"What's that you got there, Junior?"
To which Junior replied,
"It's Lucy in the sky with diamonds, Daddy."
"Shut up."
"Oh!"
To do to save his life, call his wife in. Nothing to say but what a day, how's your boy been? Nothing to do, it's up to you. I've got nothing to say but it's okay.
Good morning, good morning. going to work, don't wanna go, feeling low down. Heading for home, you start to roam, then you're in town. Everybody knows there's nothing doing, everything is closed, it's like a ruin. Everyone you see is half asleep, and you're on your own, you're in the street. After a while you start to smile, now you feel cool. Then you decide to take a walk by the old school. Nothing has changed, it's still the same. I've got nothing to say, but it's okay.
What, 64 yeah. or something Paul wrote when was we were it? In the cabin. We just stuck a few more words on it, like granny on your knee and Vera, Chuck and Dave. Yeah. It was just one of those ones that he'd had, that we've all got, really. You know, yeah. half a song that there's always... This was just one that was quite a hit with us.
Yeah.
I think we used to do it when the amps broke down, you know, just sing it on the piano.
Probably the simplest of all the tracks on the LP, which, incidentally, at that time was one of the most expensive pop albums ever made by EMI. Reputed cost of production was £25,000, and it took over 4 months to record. And more recently, John was asked by Anne Nightingale how he viewed the Sgt. Pepper album in retrospect.
When you get down to it, it was nothing more than an album called Sgt. Pepper, with the tracks stuck together, you know, with a few soundtracks. When you really... be specific about it, you know, but it was a beautiful idea then, you know, but it doesn't mean a thing now. And when you get down to each individual music on it, there's Day in the Life,
yeah,
and I can't think of anything else, you know.
Well, that's what you
really
remember, but that's really
what else is on it, you know, musically, besides the whole concept of having tracks running into each other.
But that Day in the Life that John rated so highly also ran into problems. People said it was too drug-orientated. the producer, George Martin.
This, in fact, again, was people accused us of saying it referred to puncture marks in people's arms for heroin addicts and all that kind of nonsense. The way that those lyrics came about was dead simple. John would often take his lyrics from quite ordinary, commonplace events, and that very day he'd seen a copy of the Daily Mail, which, in fact, had a report in it from one councillor of Blackburn, Lancashire, that the roads of Blackburn were absolutely disgusting and that he'd been round and he counted over 4,000 holes in the roads. And John thought this was rather funny, and I did too. And so he included it as a verse in his song, 4,000 holes in Blackburn, Lancashire. How many holes would it take to fill the Abbot Hall? Hmm. And it's as innocent as that. And I actually saw the newspaper which had this cutting on it. I think if you look in the files, you'll find it.
I read the news today, oh boy, about a lucky man who made the grade. And though the news was rather sad, well, I just had to laugh. I saw the photograph. He didn't notice that the lights had changed. A crowd of people stood and stared. They'd seen his face before. Nobody was really sure if he was on the house of law. The army had just won the war. A crowd of people turned away, but I just had to look, having read the
I read. Sergeant Pepper was their psychedelic album, and to me, the psychedelic music was really a fad. And what makes the Sergeant Pepper album good or great is that it, even as part of a fad, it transcended the fad, and it will live on for that.
Sergeant Pepper, summed up by Al Aronowitz. In May 1966, shortly after the Sergeant Pepper album, I recorded a program with Paul and asked him what else they would like to do.
The whole idea of making films is good, or a good one I like. But not, I don't mean sort of very big, expensive films, but films that you sort of just make because you fancy making a film. Yeah. You know, and I mean, when you're kids, you sort of say, let's play a game.
Yeah.
But when you've got sort of money to do things like that, to play games with almost, you know.
Yeah.
You can do the same things you did as a kid, and it's great, but you can do them, you know, on a different level completely.
Yeah.
And so, for instance, it'd be great just to say, I'd like to make a film, you know.
Do you, in fact, do this?
Yeah, with lots of things. I haven't done it with a film yet, you know, but I'd like to.
Mm.
But, I mean, the only thing is that already having got the kind of sort of image that we've got, if any of us wanted to do anything like that, we would tend to get sort of beaten down because people would say, oh, look, you know, he's not trying that old trick of making a film. Or, you know, oh, God, he's not going classical.
Yeah.
You know, and it sounds like that. But the only thing is that I thought exactly like that about people who did that too. I always used to think, you know, oh, God, there he goes, you know, going the same old path they all go, all round entertainers, you know.
Yeah.
But it's just that you find that there are some things which are just as interesting as what you've been doing.
Later on that year, Paul's ambition was to be realised with Magical Mystery Tour.
If you're going to San Francisco, be sure to wear some flowers in your hair.
In the United States and Great Britain, it was flower power time, and this record topped the charts. The American fans still hoped for a return visit by the Beatles, but the nearest they got was when George took his wife Patty to California to see Ravi Shankar at the Hollywood Bowl. It was during this visit that he wrote Blue Jay Way, called after the house they rented during their stay. When he returned, it was to take up a new interest, transcendental meditation, as taught by the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. Now, this caught the imagination of the others. What did the Maharishi preach?
I preach a simple system of transcendental meditation which gives the people the insight into life and they begin to enjoy all peace and happiness. And because this has been the message of all the saints in the past, they call me saint.
You seem also to have caught the imagination of the pop stars in this country.
What is this pop star?
People who sing with guitars. Have you anything to say about that?
I find that. You mean the Beatles?
Yes. And others.
I found them very intelligent and young men of very great potential in life.
Sexy Sadie, what have you done? Get yours yet, however big. latest and the greatest of them all.
Hunter Davis, who was writing his book on the Beatles at that time.
Yeah, I went with them the first time they went to see Maharishi, which, like all, many of the whimsical things, it happened overnight almost. I think one of them had gone along to the Hilton or somewhere, taken by a friend, and had come back and got knocked out by this bloke, and then heard he was going to Bangor, north of Wales, the next day. And his enthusiasm, presumably it was George, I've forgotten now, his enthusiasm was so great they all decided, they all packed up. And Mike McGeer, McCartney, rang me and said, the latest daft thing is they're going off to, I think you shouldn't miss this. I thought, oh God, Bangor. Saturday morning, you know, the football match on. So I thought, just in case, this is, might become interesting. So I got on the train and went off with them. And it was good for many reasons, because as I hadn't been with them on touring, this was like going on tour, because Euston Station, the press had all found out about Euston Station, was incredible. And they had Mick Jagger with them, Marianne Faithfull, and all the, you know, all the people of the day. So that train was like, I should think, their touring days in many ways, with people storming the barricades and trying to get down the corridors and having meals on the train, everybody being searched and segregated. And Bangor Station was incredible. Now, when they arrived at this place, it was full of genteel, middle-aged, middle-class ladies in this huge college hall. Then there was the Beatles, and then there was the Maharishi and his gang. It was sort of three groups that were often, almost from different ages, different time scales. And they all listened to him. And they spent the 3 days, each being indoctrinated by him.
Also down there for that weekend, the other George Harrison, the one who wrote for the Liverpool Echo.
Paul and I were talking in the university grounds, and there was a telephone in the room, in the doorway, just at the side of us. The phone began to ring, and it kept on ringing while Paul was talking, and he suddenly said, oh, George, I'll have to go and see who it is, what's going on here. Hold it a minute. And he went across there, and I waited, and I just saw him take up the receiver. And then I heard him say, oh, God, no. Oh, no, no. He put the receiver down and ran upstairs to the rooms where John and George and Ringo were staying. And the next I heard was when he came down and said, George, Brian was found dead in his bed this morning. I said, oh, Christ, it can't be. He said, yes. He was due to come to join us today, and he was found dead in his bed this morning. It's an overdose of sleeping tablets or something. I don't know anything, really, of what it is. But we've got to get back. We've got to get back to London right away.
Brian's sad and untimely death was a blow to the Beatles and everyone at NEMS. George and John talked about it that same day, August the 27th.
Well, you know, we don't know what to say. We just loved him, and he was one of us. So you can't, you know...
Pay tribute in words.
Did the Maharishi give you any words of comfort?
Yes,
His meditation gives you confidence enough to withstand something like this, even the short amount we've had.
And then the thing that we've got to know about, there's no real such thing as death anyway. I mean, it's death on a physical level, but life goes on everywhere and you just keep going, really. But so the thing is, it's not as disappointing as it is and it isn't, you know. And the thing about the comfort is to know that he's okay.
Joanne Newfield, Brian Epstein's secretary at the time, summed up the feelings of them all.
a lot of people seem to forget. They say, oh, you know, Brian didn't do that much. But if you look at the record since he's died, it makes you wonder. I mean, I think a lot of people said that the Beatles made Brian Epstein. I don't think completely Brian Epstein made the Beatles, but I think he did an awful lot. A lot of managers could have found a group like them and completely messed them up. It wasn't just a matter of just their talent alone. It was their talent plus, I think, very clever, creative person behind them. Maybe business-wise he wasn't the greatest business guy, but creatively I think he was really was marvellous for them.
To lead a better life, I need my love to be here.
Shock of Brian's death and the influence of the Maharishi in his philosophy led the boys to the realization that drugs were not providing the answers and their way of life changed. Alistair Taylor.
I think one of the major effects was completely diving into something new, which of course was Apple. Apple had started to be born, in fact, before Brian's death. But I think the boys flung themselves into it with the vigor that they did because of Brian's death. You know, it was an incredible blow. It took a long time, I think, to realise that he wasn't there anymore. So we started really hard work on Apple and creating this mythological thing. The original conception of Apple was, in fact, to open up a chain of shops, and we formed what was laughingly called the executive board, which was the four boys, Neil, Aspinall, myself, a very straight lawyer, and Clive Epstein. And as I say, the boys dived into this wholeheartedly, and from that developed something much more. It turned into this gift to mankind, almost, that anything we did, for instance, we were going to open up a shop, which is going to be very different, very freak out, working on a very marginal profit, because we did not want to be like all the other nasty business people. We wanted to be lovely and kind and give people beautiful things at very low cost. Then the record scene started to happen, and we had incredible ideas, and we were ringing up America and all sorts of things to get people over here. I think one of the plans was a messenger service around London, which nobody had then had. And it just became the Apple that was for the short period that it was.
You say yes,
1967, I got a call from Paul one Sunday, I think it was, about midday, saying, would I get in a cab immediately and go up to the house? He'd got a great idea. And which I did, as one always did if they called. And he was sitting there with a piece of paper with a circle drawn on it, divided into segments. And of course, it was the birth of Magical Mystery Tour, which was an incredible idea, in fact, which changed as we progressed, as we made it. The whole idea was, basically what did happen was take this coachload of people off round the country, and instead of saying, on your left is such and such a castle, the courier would say this, but in fact there'd be a freak out and something would be happening. This really was Paul's baby, right from the word. He put everything into it. And in fact, I got the impression at the time that the others didn't think all that much of the idea. But they did dive in, and of course we put a lot of work into it. There was a lot of fun. And I think it's rather interesting now that, particularly in view of the film that's been released now of Ken Russell's boyfriend, which everybody's sort of saying, wow, look at that, he's doing Busby Berkeley. Paul was using the Busby Berkeley idea 4 years ago.
Just what the fans' and critics' reaction was to that original film production, we'll find out in part 9 of The Beatles Story. We'll also hear how the Apple organization grew in size and scope, as well as more of their greatest music. The Beatles Story was written and produced for the BBC by Johnny Bearley.